Good evening. Welcome to the Salt Lake City Public Library Speaker Series commemorating the 150th anniversary of the nation. If you are here, I would like to recognize that the music you heard was actually performed by Zoe Carpenter and her mother on their album Tillamook Burn. My name is John Spears, and I'm the Executive Director of the Salt Lake City Public Library, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining us tonight. I'd also like to welcome our audience from SLC TV and KCBW Radio. Recordings will be available after the event. Given tonight's topic, I would also like to extend a special welcome to our audience at the J. Edgar Hoover Building in Washington, D.C., and Langley, Virginia. This week is Banned Book Weeks, and the concepts of privacy, intellectual freedom, and freedom of speech are intrinsic to public libraries. We're celebrating that this week at the City Library by offering $1 off in fines for every 10 minutes that one of our patrons reads a banned book, which we have many. This is going to be my last introduction to the Nation series, although we have one more event following this one. Unfortunately, I will be at a event for the Utah State Library. So I wanted to thank a couple of our staff members who have made this entire series possible. First, in our sound booth, Aleko Campos, our indefatigable tech wizard. I'd also like to thank Tommy Hamby, Adult Services Coordinator, for arranging so much of this program. Thank you, Tommy. Andrew Shaw, our Communications Manager. Joel Bosch, my Administrative Assistant. And then also Adam Lund, a Library Assistant. There's one other person that I want to recognize in the audience right now, and she has been a guiding light for intellectual freedom in the state of Utah, and that is Wanda Mae Huffaker, the Chair of the Utah Library Association Intellectual Freedom Committee, who is here tonight. In 2015, The Nation magazine celebrated its 150th year of publication, and it is the oldest weekly magazine in the country. The City Library's collection includes printed copies of The Nation dating back to 1880, only 15 years after its founding in 1865. And The Nation has been a home for writers instigating, reporting on, and arguing about struggles for social and economic justice. The series that we're hosting consists of 7 speakers and a film screening to note this milestone anniversary. Past topics have included reproductive rights with Katha Paulett, voting rights with Ari Berman, money in politics with John Nichols, and our last one next week will be race and policing with Michael Denzel Smith. A full lineup of all of the events is available at the table outside of the auditorium. We encourage you to visit slcpl.org/thenation for information about the series and to register for the lectures. Although registration is not required, all events in the series are, of course, free and open to the public, but registrants will be entered into a drawing to win weekly events-related prizes. Tonight's prizes are a Nation tote bag, a hat, a t-shirt, a copy of Children of the Days, A Calendar of Human History by Eduardo Galeano, and, most unique, a bottle of limited edition honey from the Library Bees, titled The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Hive, and we're very proud to say, the third place winner at the Utah State Fair. Following the speech, there will be a question and answer period, and in order to make sure that those on SLC TV, KCBW Radio, and also I should say that we are broadcasting this through Periscope as well, to make sure that they can hear your questions, please wait for a City Library staff member to bring you a microphone. Following the Q&A, there will be a reception in the lower urban room, hosted by the Friends of the City Library and the Library Store. They'll be selling books and subscriptions to The Nation, and The Nation has very graciously agreed that half of all of the subscription prices will be donated back to the Friends of the City Library. Now it is my honor to introduce Dustin Fife. I could talk about Dustin and let you know that he's the co-founder of CreativeLibrariesUtah.org and the Evil Librarians podcast. He is a 2013 Masters of Library Science graduate of Emporia State University. He's the past director of San Juan County Library. He's currently the Outreach and Patron Services Librarian at Utah Valley University, and he's also the president of the Utah Library Association. But none of that would do Dustin justice. I asked Dustin today for 3 words to describe him. And although we share an incredible respect for intellectual freedom and freedom of speech, and I agreed with the 3 words he sent me, unfortunately the FCC does not quite share our level of respect for intellectual freedom and freedom of speech, so I won't be able to tell you those, but I did agree with him. His second attempt was librarian, father, and subversive. What he doesn't know is that I also sent a message out through Facebook to 17 of his closest friends and asked them to describe Dustin in 3 words. Here's what we got. Enthusiastic, passionate, infectious, compassionate and generous of spirit, curious about the world, a model of servant leadership, fearless, willing to try anything, willing to fail, freaking hilarious, loud and tall, incorrigible, intelligent, intriguing, altruistic, confident, determined, honest, impulsive, respectful, open, friendly, charming, silly, sarcastic, and inventive, be spectacled, goofy, smarty pants, bearded, witty, and loyal, not a pushover, and a teddy bear. The 3 words I have are indefatigable, intrepid, and inspiring. Dustin is a light to Utah libraries. He's an incredible person, and I am so proud to actually call him my friend. So now I'd like to bring to the stage Dustin Fyfe.
I've absolutely never needed a microphone in my life, but I guess it's being recorded, so it might be essential for just a moment. I'm definitely a librarian because I brought 60 pages of information to do a 3-minute introduction. And, you know, I think tall, bespectacled, bearded, those are definitely the ones that describe me the best. I'm really excited about this topic, and I'm really excited about our speaker and the organization that she works for. When you think about the Nation, and you think about it being the successor to the Liberator, that it was started by abolitionists, that it is this beacon of American democracy, and to some extent, a protector of American democracy. I'm very excited to take part in this. And we're going to talk about Zoe here in just a moment, but I want to talk about the topic she's talking about tonight. And she wrote an amazing article in May called Librarians versus the NSA, and that's what you're going to talk about tonight. And this just touched me to my core because I am a librarian who's been coerced by police to try to give them information about patrons before. I'm a librarian who's kind of fighting my university right now a little bit. I talk to my director all the time about our privacy policies with our computers. They drive me a little bit crazy. These things really matter to librarianship. And at one point in her article, she quotes somebody who says that there's an ongoing argument in librarianship about whether or not libraries and librarians should be politically neutral. And I want to quash that as much as I possibly can for the audience and for anyone who will ever be in a library. There's nothing politically neutral about libraries. We have a set of values that John mentioned. We have core documents that guide us. We believe in privacy and in universal access to information and in all of these ideas that we want to support and build and give people the opportunities that they deserve, especially in a place that claims to be the greatest democracy in the world. And to do that, there can be nothing politically neutral about us. We have goals, we have missions, and we have things that we want to accomplish. So I beg all librarians and everyone here to listen to Zoe Carpenter's message tonight and listen to some of the things that are going on in our world. Zoe is, where's my page? Of all the pages, I lost the important one. There it is. Zoe is the Nation's assistant Washington editor. And from the few articles I've read from her, I do love the Nation. I've kind of followed up this week and found a few of her other articles. She's a brilliant writer and a brilliant advocate for the things that are important to libraries. And she works for an organization that shares a lot of our goals. And I love what the Nation says about itself, and it's about us. It says, We don't just talk about progress, we instigate it. There's nothing neutral about the Nation. That doesn't mean it's not good journalism. That doesn't mean that they're not people of integrity and that they don't write amazing things. But they instigate. They move us towards better things as a society, and they build us up as a democracy. And our speaker tonight has done great things for libraries and great things for our world with her work at The Nation. And I'm just excited and would encourage you to all give a big hand for Zoe Carpenter.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you to the City Library for having me and for supporting The Nation. There's particular resonance in speaking about librarians and privacy activism here, not only because we are in a fabulous library, but because we're just about 20 miles north of a physical manifestation of the creep of the surveillance state. Many of you probably know about the Utah Data Center. It's an enormous NSA facility, a data processing center, over 1 million square feet, and it takes in billions of records of emails, phone calls, the trivia of your daily life, perhaps what you ordered for dinner, your text messages. We don't really know what's happening there. Most of the activity there is classified. And that data center is actually one of the things that got Edward Snowden thinking about what he would later do in leaking the documents that he did. It was when he was learning about the capabilities of that data center, he said since then, that he really became troubled with the scope of the NSA's domestic surveillance and international surveillance as well. So shortly before his revelations started leaking to the press in 2013, James Clapper testified in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he was asked pretty directly by Senator Ron Wyden if the NSA was collecting records from millions of Americans. And his response was, quote, "not wittingly." And that answer would come to be a defining moment in the history of the U.S.'s relationship with its intelligence community. In June 2013, the stories from the leaks of Edward Snowden began to come into the press, and the first of those revelations was that Verizon records from its customers had been collected by the NSA on an ongoing daily basis for years. Millions of users' records were collected, and these were records of who they'd called, at what time, perhaps even the location from which they were calling. And so that was startling enough in itself that the NSA was doing that. But for people who'd been paying close attention to the intelligence community and the debate about the Patriot Act, what was almost more surprising was how the government was justifying that program. They were using a section of the Patriot Act called Section 215, which was previously known, or colloquially known, as the Library Records Provision. And so that's what brings us tonight to the discussion of libraries and the NSA, and more broadly, the surveillance state. So Section 215 is a part of the Patriot Act that justifies or authorizes the collection of tangible things without a usual warrant. And that section of the Patriot Act was something that librarians were perhaps most vocal about following the passage of the Patriot Act, and when not a lot of other people were speaking out. Librarians have been at the forefront of the privacy debate for a very long time. It's been one of the core values in their mission statement since 1939, based around the principle that in order to have true freedom of inquiry and freedom of expression, you also have to have an expectation of privacy. And so throughout history, there have been many examples of librarians who've been involved in activism. But the post-9/11 era was really a watershed moment when the Patriot Act passed with very little congressional debate and very little public scrutiny. Librarians were some of the strongest voices calling for a deeper evaluation of the implications for civil liberties. In particular, they were worried about Section 215 because it authorized the collection of library records that included things like circulation records, patron lists, also internet search histories and computer hard drives. And librarians were very quick to recognize the threat that this posed to their patrons' privacy. And the reason this section was targeted to librarians, or the reason they were actually written into libraries was written into the Patriot Act at all, was because after 9/11, it came out that some of the hijackers had used a public library in Florida to go on the internet, basically. And so there was some concern in Congress that libraries were going to be a quote-unquote safe haven for terrorists and bad actors. James Sensenbrenner, a Wisconsin representative who is now a critic of the Patriot Act and how it's been interpreted, said at the time that we put Americans' lives at risk if we foolishly provide sanctuaries, even in our public libraries, for terrorists to operate. So what this meant was that those records could be requested via subpoena, and in many cases that subpoena would be accompanied by a gag order, which would forbid librarians from speaking about the requests that they'd gotten to anyone. So we really don't know how many librarians have been asked for records under the Patriot Act, although almost immediately there began to be talk that librarians were indeed receiving these requests. But despite those rumors and the concern from librarians, the government was insistent that Section 215 was not being used to target libraries, and that it would not be. There are some pretty famous quotes from John Ashcroft, who is the architect of the Patriot Act, who was forced to respond to the outcry from librarians, and he did so by accusing them of baseless hysteria. And he used the word hysteria or hysterical 6 times in one speech to refer to librarians and their concerns. And he said that the FBI had no interest in, quote, checking how far you've gotten in the latest Tom Clancy novel. But librarians were already fighting back and doing what they could, even with the Patriot Act on the books. So that included things just like posting simple informational signs. Perhaps some of you saw them back in the day that said things like, this computer may be monitored by the FBI. There would be community meetings. There were more direct challenges, such as a concerted effort to destroy records, the thought being that if we couldn't stop the government from requesting them, we could make sure that the records didn't in fact exist. So there was a wonderful quote in a New York Times article from a librarian who said, it used to be that librarians were pictured with a book, but now it's a librarian with a shredder. There was this really creative form of resistance and public awareness building that was coming up from the libraries in a way that it wasn't coming up from all of the other civic institutions after the Patriot Act. I spoke with one young woman who remembers being in her library and seeing a sign that said, the FBI has not been here. And then in small print below it said, watch for the removal of this sign. The thought being that if you got a gag order and couldn't talk about it, you could still remove the sign and that wouldn't violate your gag order. So this was going on. Ashcroft was saying, no, don't worry about it. The Patriot Act is no big deal. And although his patronizing tone was not appreciated, some librarians took him at his word, including a man named George Christian, who worked for a consortium of libraries in Connecticut. And he was a little worried about Section 215, and he made some preparations, informing his staff of what the procedure was if they received a request. But then he told me that he basically didn't forget about it, but sort of put it out of his mind and went on to other things, until one day there was a knock at his door, and 2 FBI agents showed up with badges and served him a subpoena for records from a particular computer at one of the libraries that he managed, accompanied with a gag order forbidding him from talking about the request. Now, we know about this because George Christian decided to challenge the request, and he and 3 other librarians joined in a suit filed by the ACLU to challenge both the gag order and this request. And the case is known as the Connecticut Four. I imagine that some of you are familiar. And this case was a very significant moment, not just in terms of librarians' advocacy around privacy, But in terms of the larger public awareness of what was being done under the Patriot Act, eventually the names of the librarians were found out by Barton Gellman from the Washington Post, and he wrote a very long story exploring not just the case, but the dramatic escalation of the government's domestic surveillance programs. At that point, 30,000 requests were being made every year via national security letters, which are not overseen by a jury or judge. And that case seemed to sort of vindicate what a lot of people in the community had been saying about the danger. But again, it was difficult to talk about because this was the only case where the librarians had such a public challenge. And even while the case was ongoing, they weren't allowed to speak about it. And this was all happening when the Patriot Act was being reauthorized in 2006. And there was a funny coincidence in timing, which was that Congress reauthorized Section 215 without reforming it significantly. And just weeks later, the government happened to lift the gag order. And by then, of course, it was too late for George Christian and his colleagues to have much influence in the congressional debate. Around that same time, in 2006, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, so the court that rules on the government's requests for information under Section 215 and other authorities, was broadening its interpretation of the statute to include things like the phone metadata program that we later learned about from Edward Snowden. So all this is happening behind the scenes, and people have begun to forget a little bit about the implications of the Patriot Act. It's no longer in the news as much. Years go by. In Congress, there is a small minority of senators and representatives who are concerned about the creep of the surveillance state, Ron Wyden from Oregon being one of them. And it's interesting looking back now that we know what we know from Snowden's leaks, to see how they went about trying to tell the public that something was going on, but they were bound by classified information. So we continued to see this cycle of vague concerns being raised in congressional hearings, questioning, like Ron Wyden's questioning of James Clapper. But the government continued to deny that it was using these statutes for broad domestic surveillance in the way that we now know that it was. So then the Snowden revelations happened, and they again were a vindication of the critics and the people who'd been concerned about the implications of Section 215 and other elements of the intelligence community and their implications for civil liberties. And what I have been really interested in and what I wrote about in the spring was how those leaks reinvigorated the library community and its work on surveillance issues and privacy issues. I will say that there are people in the room who probably know much more about this than I do from the inside, and so I look forward to hearing from them during the Q&A. So there are sort of two branches, as far as I can tell, for how the library community has responded. So one is at the federal legislative level. The American Library Association is very involved in lobbying for reforms to the Patriot Act and other laws. And they've been encouraging members to participate in advocacy, not necessarily around issues of privacy, but that's certainly one thing that members could be active in. But what I've been particularly interested and inspired by is the community level and individual level work that many librarians are doing to bring libraries to the forefront of digital privacy and to push back in a practical way as well as a intellectual way to the creep of the surveillance state. One of the projects that's come out since Snowden is called the Library Freedom Project, and it's run by a librarian from the Northeast named Allison Macrina, who will actually be here giving workshops on November 15th, I believe. So if you're interested, I'm sure the library staff can tell you more about that. And the guiding philosophy behind her project and some of this community-level activism and awareness raising is that although the government's surveillance powers seem overwhelming and intrusive and in many ways unstoppable, particularly given the makeup of Congress, there's actually a lot that we can do as individuals to control how much data we're giving out. So it's sort of the same principle as librarians using a shredder to destroy paper records. When we go online, we leave trails that can be picked up not just by the government, but by corporations who want to mine our personal data and use it for advertising purposes and other purposes too. But we don't have to give all this information away. There are tools out there. There is software. There are habits that we can adopt that can conceal some of our information, that can stop the trail from being as easily picked up. And so what Allison McCrean is doing and what other librarians are doing around the country is trying to make this part of the librarianship's best practices to use these tactics and to protect their patrons and also to teach their library users how to use this technology themselves. One example of that is something called Tor, which is a browser like Internet Explorer or Chrome or Safari. It's a browser that bounces web traffic around from different users, and so it's hard to track which traffic is coming from which user. So that's a fairly simple program that can protect your information. I'm not a particularly tech-savvy person, so if you have more questions about how that works, Allison will address them in her workshop. And so this isn't without controversy. Although it seems relatively simple, Allison has worked with a library in New Hampshire, and that library became the first library to participate in Tor's project. And the Department of Homeland Security actually sent a letter to state police, which then contacted local police, informing them that this could provide a haven for child pornographers and other criminals. And so there was a big debate. The library halted its program temporarily and had a community meeting, and the board met and discussed and ended up voting unanimously to restart the program. And the chairman of the library board explained that decision. He told a local reporter, "With any freedom, there is risk. And it came to me that I could vote in favor of the good or I could vote against the bad. I'd rather vote for the good because there is value in this." So we're seeing pushback from the intelligence agencies already for librarians being involved in this sort of thing, which is interesting. And I think that's a much broader debate than libraries, and it's one that has animated the debate in Congress also, is are security and privacy on two ends of a spectrum, and do you have to choose one or the other, or do you in fact enhance security by increasing people's civil liberties and having a society that is more free and democratic? And that's a debate that libraries are at the forefront of right now. Regarding the debate in the library community about whether librarianship should be politically neutral, I think another way to put that is perhaps a debate about what it means to put the principles of intellectual freedom, of upholding intellectual freedom, into practice. What does it mean when it comes to a specific circumstance as opposed to an abstract declaration of support? And so that question came up somewhat recently in a June 2013 meeting of the American Library Association. A committee put forward a resolution to recognize Edward Snowden as a whistleblower, quote, who has performed a valuable service in launching a national dialogue about transparency, domestic surveillance, and overclassification. And that resolution to recognize Edward Snowden passed easily. And then the next day, there was an unusual move made to reconsider the motion. And the member who put forward the resolution argued that the original resolution had been put forward in haste and that it might compromise the ability of the Washington office of the ALA to work with legislators and to work with the Obama administration. And so there was this big debate there. And in fact, the council ended up voting to rescind the resolution in support of Edward Snowden and passed a substitute resolution that didn't name him but called for more explicit protections for whistleblowers. And so this sort of gets to the heart of the debate. Snowden has become a politicized figure, and some people that I spoke with in a follow-up story that I did who did not support the Snowden resolutions felt that it was inappropriate to single him out and that it unnecessarily politicized the situation, that it was better to vote for something, to vote for a positive policy, such as a whistleblower protection, rather than to make a what they felt was an abstract show of support for Snowden. On the other hand, the people who'd put forward the Snowden resolution felt that at that time, in 2013, shortly after his leaks had come to light, when he was being demonized by many people in the administration, in Congress, and in the press, that it was important to have a show of support for him, and it was important to take a specific instance of intellectual freedom and privacy being on the line and make a declaration about that. And they also pointed out that the ALA had previously called for whistleblower protection, so it was a bit redundant to do so again. Regardless of where you stand on that debate about that specific resolution regarding Snowden, I do think it's hard to imagine that we would be having a debate about Section 215, that we would be talking about the Library Awareness Program so much in 2015 at all if it hadn't been for him. Many of his critics will say that this debate is necessary and it's good that we're having it, but we could have had it another way. He should have done this through official channels. He shouldn't have leaked the information. He did raise these issues, and if you look at the efforts from Senator Wyden and others in Congress who were trying to have this discussion and bring it to public attention and were unable to do so despite being on the relevant committees and having the relevant information, it's a little hard to see how else we might have had this discussion publicly. So Allison Macrina isn't the only librarian who's working on these issues. I found out about them because the D.C. Public Library, I live in D.C., had a 10-day series of events under the umbrella of Orwellian America, and it included a 24-hour reading of 1984. It included an encryption workshop. It included a variety of other community participatory programs oriented around the themes of surveillance and privacy and intellectual freedom. And as I explored, I found that programs like this were happening at libraries all around the country, which probably isn't surprising to those of you who are deeply embedded in the library community. But I thought it was a really interesting challenge to the stereotype that I think some people have of libraries as being somehow stuck in a past age, being dinosaurs of dusty books. As much as I love dusty books, so that doesn't bother me so much, but... what I discovered was that librarians are really, in many cases, at the forefront of some of this digital technology. There are dozens of libraries that offer public access to 3D printers, and that's very special and something that most people don't have access to anywhere else. And I think the other reason that it's so significant that libraries are involved in this debate about surveillance and the intelligence community is that it does seem so disempowering sometimes, at least to me, especially given the current status in Congress. It's hard to imagine that there will be sweeping changes, even if there are some very good changes at the legislative level, which I'll talk about in a minute. But so bringing these community participatory trainings, what I found in my reporting was that it was a really different way of tackling the problem and a very empowering way to say there is something that you can do. You can sit down for a couple of hours and learn some real steps that will help protect privacy and bring a huge national and international issue down to a personal level. And my sense is that it's that kind of awareness building that actually will ultimately have more success in building the sort of democratic consensus that ultimately will be necessary to push for reforms at the legislative level, getting people to care about how it affects them. So I thought that was really exciting about these programs. Another thing is that libraries serve members of communities who are traditionally more at risk for surveillance. Immigrants, people of color, political dissidents and activists, And so having them involved with this conversation with their users and thinking about how best to protect their users, I think is really, really essential. One of the things about Section 215 and the targeting of libraries by the FBI and the all of that more recently is that this isn't the first time that that's happened. This all has echoes going back to a Cold War project called the Library Awareness Program, in which the FBI tried to spy on the reading habits of Soviet nationals, mostly, who were using research and scientific libraries and technological libraries, and trying to co-opt librarians into that project as spies, in effect. So this is, you know, we've seen this throughout history that libraries as a democratic place of inquiry, are going to be at risk from any attempts to control that information flow. Let me check the time here. So getting back to the legislative arena, we had this big debate. Snowden sparked a big debate. People were shocked. And Congress was, some members of Congress were fired up, and we had a really amazing coalition of groups, which included the American Library Association, and included groups like the ACLU, and technology groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, many of the big tech companies who were pushing for reform. And this provided the first big chance for surveillance reform since the Patriot Act had passed. We saw some pretty devious attempts to water down legislation in the House, to defang it. And what ended up passing the Senate and the House this spring is actually a very significant reform. It is the first major reform of surveillance laws since the Patriot Act passed, and including reforms to Section 215, the library records provision. And I think certainly the early attention that librarians brought to the issue and the continued involvement played a big role in how that provision was seen and what people knew about it. So what the reform does is it makes it more difficult for the government to put gag orders on requests for information. It means that the government won't be able to have the dragnet collection of phone records that it had before, although it will still be able to request specific information from the phone companies. But it doesn't do away with Section 215, which is what many people had called for. It certainly doesn't do away with the Patriot Act entirely. And it doesn't get at other aspects of the intelligence legal apparatus, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and the national security letters. So those things are still issues, and the momentum has been sapped a little bit since we no longer have that steady drip of leaks from Snowden. And so I think this ongoing work that libraries are doing with the Privacy Workshop is vital for keeping that conversation alive, even if Congress's attention is turned elsewhere, such as shutting down the government. And the other major issue that the latest reform of Section 215 didn't get at is a broader question of balance of power. When you think about the fact that James Clapper was able to say under oath that the government was not wittingly collecting records from millions of Americans and not have any repercussion, he was able to keep his job and in fact earn high praise. And then when you hear that the CIA spied on Senate staffers who were preparing a report on the CIA's torture practices, it really raises the question of whether Congress, in fact, can oversee the intelligence community. And that's a much bigger issue than what's actually in Section 215. Does Congress even have the ability to know exactly what the government is doing, how the government is justifying its activities and what it's doing? The revelation that we were spying on Angela Merkel, which was greeted with so much shock by members of the Intelligence Committee, suggests that the overseers, in fact, don't know everything that they should be overseeing. So that's a much bigger issue, and I think something that will not be solved soon. Many people have called for a renewed Church Committee, which was a whole series of very in-depth congressional hearings and investigations previously. And I don't know that we're likely to see that anytime soon. In fact, it seems pretty clear that we're not going to see it soon. But I think that to really get to the root at the legacy of the Patriot Act as it affects libraries, as it affects all of us, we probably would need something like that. So I'm actually going to stop here just a couple minutes early, because with so many librarians in the room and people who've been involved in this issue from the inside, I want to make sure we leave extra time for Q&A and discussion. Thank you.
So if you want to just raise your hand, come on up with the microphone.
Oh, no questions.
Oh, good. Oh, good. We get to hear more from Dustin.
What was it like working with the librarians on stories like these to get them to open up, to kind of get them talking? It seems like it wasn't particularly difficult to find passionate people, but did you have anyone push back?
I did talk to a few people who did feel that this was becoming too politicized, and they didn't really want to be involved in that broader debate about whether the intelligence community had too much power and what specific legislation should pass. And I think the Snowden issue was where I found a lot more disagreement. And people, you know, one person at first told me the issue was too politicized, and I asked him, well, how do you draw the line between what is a political issue and what isn't? And he sort of agreed that to some extent everything is politicized and subjective. And so at some point it was just his own personal opinion. So I think the Snowden issue is where I got the most pushback. In terms of what it was like to, in general, to work with the librarians, this was probably one of the most fun stories that I've ever worked on, because librarians are so smart and interesting and inquisitive. And I talked to, one of the interesting things was speaking with librarians in their 20s and early 30s who were brought into librarianship because of the activism after the Patriot Act was passed. And many people that I spoke with, including Allison Macrina, said that for them, seeing these signs in the libraries and hearing from their librarians about the Patriot Act was both a sort of political awakening and a lesson in being critical of the official story, but it also really inspired them about the profession. And so that was cool to hear that this activism was sort of feeding on itself by bringing new people into the fold. Someone in the back here.
Thank you for speaking here and addressing this subject, because I think it's vitally important. Could you just say very briefly how the situation's being addressed and handled in other major nations and regions of the world that have significant, library resources and traditions?
You know, I actually didn't do a ton of research on the international context. So in terms of how they're handling the privacy stuff, I'm not sure about libraries specifically. I know that other countries and more broadly are looking for ways to now circumvent U.S. tech companies in some cases, because they know that networks that are going to go through American companies aren't going to be protected. Whether that's through companies voluntarily turning over information and participating with the intelligence agencies, as some have, or whether it's going to be through more secretive work on the part of the government. So that's part of the reason you saw tech companies like Google joining these coalitions, because they're worried about their competitiveness. But if there's a librarian in the room who knows about that international context and wants to speak to it, I'd be interested to hear as well. Down here, maybe? Oh.
I have a question. Unlike other wars we've been in, the war on terror is likely to be unendable almost, at least go on for years and years and years. Do you foresee that the tendency of the government to want to have more information because of the perceived ongoing threat, perpetual threat, and the insecurities of people, that this is likely to be a danger for a long time to come?
I think it really is. There's, you know, the forces of inertia are quite strong when it comes to taking away civil liberties under the pretense of security. You know, we had a whole commission that investigated the intelligence failures that led up to 9/11. And none of those failures, none of the major failures, had to do with the fact that libraries weren't being watched close enough, or that the intelligence agencies didn't have enough information. The problem was not that they didn't have the information. The problem was that they weren't using it in a way that was coordinated, and in a way that led to insightful analysis. So what happened with the Patriot Act, and what's happened since 9/11, is that we vastly expanded the ability of intelligence agencies to collect data abroad and at home, and to store that data, and to do so in secret via the secret of court. And yet, we have no assurance that we've actually changed what they do with the data in terms of analysis. And in fact, there are many people, including people who used to work for the NSA, who say that the problem is that there's too much information, and that we just have this massive dump of stuff flowing through our servers, perhaps being stored in, you know, just 20 miles south of here, and it's not actually making us any safer. If you think about the actual attempted terrorist attacks, the underwear bomber, the Times Square bomber, those weren't picked up. So, and neither have the other examples of domestic terrorism, which, by the way, are more often committed by white Christians than foreign Muslims, I think, is an interesting thing that we don't really think about if we're, how we're targeting. Not to say that we should increase surveillance on those people either, but one does wonder where our priorities are in that sense. But sorry, getting back to your question, I think that this is, it's a philosophical issue, and that's why it's not going to be solved quickly, about what makes us safe. And I think that there is the attitude that what makes us safe is a more repressive regime of surveillance and control that has a lot of political currency right now. Down here in the front. Oh, sorry, you have a mic. Great.
Yeah. I am really interested in the university libraries. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what was happening and being expected of them. And I'll say UVU might be a special case, as I just retired from there. Before the reform and after the reform, and how the expectations are given to the university librarians, and who gets the information?
Yeah, I mean, my sense from my reporting is that it varies by university. Which perhaps is an issue that there isn't a standard set of best practices. I don't know if there was a specific incident that you're referring to at UBU, but I think, like public libraries, it's up to that particular institution to make their own policies around that. I do know that after 9/11 there were some incidences. One university library where staff called law enforcement because they saw quote-unquote Middle Eastern-looking men reading Islamic newspapers on computers and whispering suspiciously. I was under the assumption that you were supposed to whisper in a library. So so I do know that there has been controversy in the university system about how much library staff should cooperate with requests for information. And and what the legal framework is in terms of whether it's the campus who's responsible for, you know, when a subpoena is issued, or whether it's the library, and whether the library can install Tor, or whether the administration has to give permission for something like that. So certainly that is a subject of controversy. Let's go here on the edge.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi.
So I actually just graduated in 2012 with my master in library and information science, and I never took any courses in patron privacy. So I'm wondering if you spoke with any faculty members in library science departments across the United States about incorporating this particular topic in the curriculum.
I didn't, and that's a very good question. I think the more sophisticated encryption techniques and stuff like that, I think because this is all sort of new post Snowden, I imagine that if it's been incorporated, it's been very recent. And so probably the fact that it wasn't part of your curriculum has to do with the timing too. Go ahead.
Hi, just to get to the international question, the concept of public libraries are almost a distinctly American invention to some extent, and they do exist throughout the world. Countries in Europe, Asia, South America, everywhere have public libraries, but they're run very differently depending on the country. And the concept of intellectual freedom and how it plays out in the public libraries is very much dependent on what the overarching structure within that country itself already is. I think one of the reasons that this has risen at the forefront in the United States is that this is such kind of an abrogation of the history of what public libraries stand for. And it's in some ways almost insidious as to what's happened. Every state actually has public libraries structured very differently. Although in most states they are actually constitutionally created. What's happened, though, in the United States is that there's federal legislation such as the Children's Internet Protection Act that has put restrictions on libraries that keep us currently from doing things like installing Tor, although that is actually a open discussion right now. And what that means is that if libraries did do things in the United States that would go against some of these restrictions, all of our federal funding would be yanked. There's an institution called the Institute of Museum and Library Services that is the public agency that oversees libraries in the United States. They grant an incredible amount of money directly, and then they also do sub-grants through something called the Library Services and Technology Act through state libraries. Just as one example, and I'm going to use the City Library for that, the City Library was the last public library in the state of Utah to institute filters on our computers. Until we did so, we were not eligible for state grants or federal grants. They have public libraries over a barrel to some extent because it is a huge amount of money that is made available. In foreign countries, it's a little bit different. I can tell you that for instance, in the Scandinavian countries, it's not as much of an issue. The governments there have an incredible healthy respect. In Britain, it's almost a given the government's going to be spying on you. In South America, the concept of a public library is almost non-existent. So it really does depend on where you're located. I don't know if that actually answered the question, but I hope so.
Thank you for that, yeah. Sure, down here in the front.
I have a question in the form of a scenario. If this NSA data center intercepts a phone call, and they tell the FBI or whoever, we've got to get this guy's reading list in the library. And if they do that, and if the media finds out about that independently, wouldn't they be covered under this gag order that they could not report this? If you could talk a little bit about the media in this.
Yeah, the media is protected, and the gag order is normally applies just to the person who's issued the subpoena, or to the institution that it's involved. The press is somewhat outside of that. So if in fact the press found out from the librarian who had gotten the subpoena, then the librarian would be in trouble. And so that's one of the reasons that journalists are so adamant about protecting their sources, is because we have a certain immunity that our sources don't in cases like that. I'm not a lawyer, but my sense is that the journalist, if they found out about that request through independent means, would be free to report it. Like other national security issues, normally, if it's a serious national security issue, the editor of the publication would inform the government that they're going to publish. And usually the government will try to say, you're going to endanger personnel overseas or something, and try to squash that. And we've seen that with certain revelations. You know, the New York Times has held stories before on the government's request, and other times has published them. Those things happen. Yeah. Let's open the Hawaiian shirt back there.
How much of our taxpayer dollars are spent on this program per year and on per individual?
I don't have those figures in front of me, but certainly they are. I would bet that they are vastly more than our public dollars that are spent on libraries, to the tune of tens, if not hundreds. The data center was at a cost of more than $1 billion alone just to construct that center, and that doesn't. That doesn't include how much it costs to then run it every day. So, yeah.
One of the historic ways that I guess we've pushed back against communities that have insisted on some sort of censorship in their local libraries has been to advertise banned books, mm-hmm. to try to make it very clear broadly that there are parts of the community that are trying to restrict access to this. I'm wondering about whether there have been efforts to explain or to actually quantify in some way the effects of the intimidation or the limits of the effects of surveillance on, let's say, the democratic process. And if that's a way to publicize that, that might be an effective way to push back.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure how you would quantify that. I imagine you could do a randomized survey of library users, for example. I'm not sure how you would control. I think in many cases that kind of chilling effect isn't necessarily experienced overtly, but it has a suppressive effect that one may not recognize. So I'm not sure if you did a survey if that would actually capture that result. I think an example might be someone who's interested in an idea that might be considered a dangerous idea and wants to research that idea, even if they're not a subscriber to that belief. That becomes more risky in a context of constant surveillance. But I don't know that most people think about that necessarily. I think you might then see that come into play in a legal case where someone had no idea that researching jihad might later get them in trouble, or that could be a suspicious sign. They were just working on a research paper for their Islamic studies class or something, right? But yeah, that's a very interesting question about how we would quantify that. Right behind you, there's a question.
I'm just curious to know how you got interested in the topic initially.
Yeah, good question. I have always loved libraries. I spent a lot of time as a kid in a library in a small town in Oregon where my grandmother was a volunteer. And I still use the public library. And so in DC, I happened to hear about their privacy workshop, that 10-day Orwellian America series, just through an email that I got from their newsletter. And so I decided to go thinking that it might be just something that I was interested in personally, and maybe I'd write a blog post about it or something. And then once I started researching, I got really interested in the history of the activism. I'm pretty young, so I wasn't aware of that library activism in 2003, 2004 when it was happening. But I found it fascinating. And so that's when I started diving into the story and realizing that there was a lot more here. And I was also broadly interested in these issues about the intelligence community and the Patriot Act as it was coming up for reauthorization. And so telling this story about how librarians were involved seemed like a really good hook to get people to think about it differently rather than just to say, you should all care about the Patriot Act, which is kind of dry.
On to the question of, you mentioned banned books has its own week.
Mm-hmm.
American Library Association a number of years ago started National Privacy Week.
Right.
Which they have the first week of May. And if you go onto that site, they have so very many links and resources. A lot of authors have now joined in and joined the cause and gotten celebrities to join the cause.
Yep.
And so you can go in and there's a lot of research and a lot of sources, a lot of links, a lot of causes. It's grown and grown and grown. So there is a lot of material there where you can get more information than I can't even read it all because they've added so much to it. So there is a lot more information on privacy on that site. You can just do ALA Privacy Week mm-hmm. and link to it there, and that may be very helpful on privacy issues for more. It's not quite as big as banned books, but it's very much newer than that.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion and a great resource. And you can also find resolutions that the ALA has passed or debated that implicate some of these issues if you're interested in how broad legislation affects librarians and libraries at that specific level.
I think we can all agree that we live in an era of oversharing. So I was just wondering if you think that people are oversharing nowadays because they are not aware of the fact that NSA is collecting all this data on them, or is it just because they don't care?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think most people assume that the NSA doesn't care about the selfie that they posted on Facebook. And there's this argument that if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't care about surveillance. But I think people just don't realize the implications. Number one, you're giving away personal information that you don't know. I think we don't realize how useful it is to not only the government, but to corporations. We're allowing people to profit off of our personal information and our personal connections. And maybe we don't care about that, but we are being mined for our information. And the other thing is, even if you personally don't feel like you have any issue with your information being vacuumed up and gone through by the government, the broader point is that what matters is the architecture that's being built for this kind of data collection and this kind of surveillance. Even if you trust the Obama administration, which is sort of the line the administration has taken, is trust us, we're doing fine things with this power. That doesn't, even if you buy that and think and trust the Obama administration, they're not going to be in power forever. And we are creating an architecture, a legal framework, a technological system that allows this kind of surveillance. And right now, the fact that you post a photo of yourself reading Toni Morrison, the fact that that's fine now doesn't mean that in 50 years that might not be an issue. And I know that sounds kind of ridiculous, but we don't know what political changes are going to happen and how that information can be seen. And especially because all this information can be mined through retroactively, we can imagine a scenario where the law enforcement agency might conduct or might create a very selective profile of a person based on certain pieces of information without context that could end up looking very incriminating. So even if you think that the sum total of your Facebook and your Gmail is not incriminating, what if they just pick out a sentence here and there and your connection to someone overseas, and that becomes much more troubling. And so I think people just don't think about it on that large of a scale. You here in the middle?
Two comments. The first one is in the World War I era and post-World War I, there were a lot of people who were interested in the academic aspects of other types of government, and they might have attended or joined meetings of organizations that supported labor movements and communal movements. And then 20 years later, it's announced that they joined a communist organization and McCarthy had his heyday.
Right.
That could very well happen to us 20 years from now if you join the American Library Association, for example. Another question I'd like to ask is this. Can you elaborate on what happened to the Connecticut Four and whether we have any hard data on how much intrusion into public libraries there is under the auspices of 215?
Right. That's maybe perhaps one of the most troubling aspects is we do not have hard data. That's the only major case that we know about because it was one of the only ones that was fought in court and that led to a successful lifting of a gag order. So we just have no idea. There was a survey that was taken shortly after the Patriot Act passed of a variety of libraries around the country, and it found that more than 80 had received requests. So we know that it's significant, and that included requests that were made under other authorities, but those were all terror-related, and some of them we would assume were under Section 215. With the reforms, it may be harder, and libraries are more protected with the reformed Section 215, but that's certainly something that we just don't know. We don't have a way to quantify that. Sure.
So as you know, working at the Nation, what are the conversations like, a self-proclaimed progressive, left-sided magazine when you see the Obama administration pushing back against the Freedom Act, when you see their response to Edward Snowden, and they're saying, trust us, but there's clear that on this issue, there's from, you know, any of our recent presidents, there's nothing to trust. What at a magazine like The Nation, what is that conversation like with your editorial board and with your colleagues?
It's certainly a lively one. I wasn't on staff in before the 2012 election, but I was freelancing a little bit, and I do remember conversations about, you know, would the magazine endorse Obama for a second term, given his record on national security issues, not just on intelligence, but on drone strikes and other matters of foreign policy. Certainly there is a significant move towards diplomacy in some areas. The Iran nuclear accord is something that I think is very significant and could be very significant depending on how it all works out, and is certainly a big change in policy and practice from the Bush years. On the other hand, it's hard to deny that the Obama administration has carried over and in many cases further entrenched some of the worst practices of the administration, not only when it comes to intelligence, but we have the Obama administration has its own legacy in terms of drone strikes.
I became a librarian in 1998, shortly before 2001. Mm-hmm. And, I remember sitting around the staff table at one of the first libraries I worked at, holding up salt shakers and speaking into it as a joke. And it's amazing the ebb and flow of what this issue has become. And I'm wondering if you're somewhat disillusioned or somewhat disheartened by the fact that in the current election, this seems to be non-existent as a topic of conversation.
Yeah, it's non-existent at all. And I think it would be very interesting to see if it comes out in the Democratic debates, because I think it probably almost certainly most likely will not in any substantive way in the GOP debates. I would be very interested to see the contrast on matters of intelligence between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, for example, and if Biden declares, because he's been in the administration, I would imagine that I'm curious about what his perspective is. So it's disheartening in some way, but then that's why I'm so excited about the work that the librarians are doing. And that's why I wanted to write this story, is because that's something that feels like things are actually happening there. You can actually learn how to use an encrypted browser. And even if in the grand scheme of things, it seems like a small thing, it is something. And so that's what I find very hopeful, is that there are still things that we can do ourselves to stand up for civil liberties. And I think my time is up. So thank you all very much. It was a pleasure to be here.